This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. Stop waiting around for the perfect candidate. Instead, use Indeed-sponsored jobs to find the right people with the right skills fast. It's a simple way to make sure your listing is the first candidate see. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs have 4 times more applicants than non-sponsored jobs. So go build your dream team today with Indeed. Get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com. It's prime time for hitting the woods, and when you do, you need to know where you're going. And the best tool for the job is the Onyx Hunt app, which just keeps getting better and better. I've used Onyx for almost a decade now, and it's far and away my most used hunting tool. From making sure you're within a property boundary to peeling back the layers of an area with leaf-off imagery, the Onyx Hunt app will help you understand a property quicker than anything. As we head into the peak season, I've been using the LiDAR feature in the Topo base map to spot areas that will funnel deer through a specific location, and the slope angle exposure layer to get an idea of how much sunlight reaches an area and predict how my thermals will behave. To try it out for yourself and have more success this fall, go visit onxmaps.com/hunt. Fall is here and it's time to get out in the woods, and when you do, you need gear that's going to keep you warm, dry, and concealed while you're pursuing wild game. That's why I'm proud to be partners with Huntworth Gear, the makers of badass, affordable hunting gear that's readily available and won't break the bank. You've heard me talk about this gear for years now, and for good reason. Their Heat Boost gear is the warmest hunting gear I've ever worn, and guys, I promise you, I'm not just saying that. It beats the heck out of traditional merino, fleece, or down hunting clothes. Not to mention, we've got a ton of great new camo patterns, including our new waterfowl pattern, Oberus, which has been expertly designed to keep you concealed from wary ducks flying overhead. To go get kitted out for this fall, visit huntworthgear.com or head on over to the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're all doing well. I hope you survived last week's little polar vortex that rolled through. You ice fishermen, I know, are going to be happy with all that, although you might have to bring a little extra juice for the auger or some gusto if you're doing it by hand. But us trout fishermen are just sitting here, stuck inside, watching you guys have fun, although not being willing to admit that it might be fun to ice fish. At least I'm not. I don't know. I can't give that one up quite yet, but we'll see. We'll see. At least for now. I don't know. After I tie a few more flies and drive myself crazy inside, maybe I'll get out on the ice and be willing to give it a shot. But you guys, I've got Eric Johnson, the community manager for Trout Routes, on the line. Very trouty, fishy fella. Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Pierce. It's good to be out here with you today. I am struggling. I have been tying flies kind of like crazy over the last couple weeks, but I am ready for this cold weather to kick so we can get back out on the water. That's for sure.
Dude, right? It's just, I don't know. The colder it gets and the longer it stays this way, the more, I don't want to say depressed I'm getting, but we know inside it's like, okay, great. Like, it's going to be warm. We might have that 50 degree day or something, but then all the runoff and all the ice melt and everything, that's just going to chill the stream. Like, the fishing's going to suck for a minute now. So
it always takes me quite a while to kind of build up that thicker skin to even tolerate the cold. So I tend to avoid that cold weather as much as possible in the first half of the season. And then, like you said, you get all these little glimmers of hope of what potentially looks like it might be a nice day. And then you remind yourself, oh, well, if it's going to be nice for me, it's not going to be nice for the fish because all that cold snow melt. Mm-hmm. And, it's just kind of one crushing defeat after another until we get into late March. But that's right. That's what makes those early spring days that much more rewarding, I feel like.
Oh, totally. That first day when the ice is finally gone and you get that first little hatch and you see those fish start to rise a little bit. And it's like, ooh, wait, I can throw like a 20 today? Weird.
Right.
This would be fun, maybe. I don't know. Like, just, I don't know. Gets the juices flowing and finally get a little bit of vitamin D and everything. But I'll tell you what, 100%. These days in particular make you really jealous for the buddies who go and do some saltwater fishing. And I got a buddy who just got back from Belize. I got another buddy who's headed down to Argentina. He might be down in Argentina right now, actually.
Yeah, we've got some folks on the team down in Argentina right now. And I see her updates come through and I'm like, oh man, that looks like fun. some open water, some big trout, some good streamside food. So I gotta get on that program one of these winters. But
I don't know. Gotta just crunch the numbers, figure out how we can make that like a write off or something.
And,
or some sort of a professional development opportunity.
Yeah, right? Or chalk it up to some R&D, perhaps.
Totally. And, totally. Exactly. Yeah, we got to get trout routes rolling in Argentina. Right. They have a use for it. Well, dude, can you tell us a little bit about where, yourself and kind of where you're from and how you got to doing what you're doing now with Trout Routes?
Yeah, 100%, man. I'm in Wisconsin now, as we were chatting a little bit before we hit that record button. I'm also out in the Driftless these days with my family, but grew up in the Twin Cities and didn't really get into fly fishing until after college, just because I didn't have a whole lot of family that was into it, and hadn't really been in parts of the country that had as much trout fishing opportunities as a place like the Driftless does. And so I grew up, you know, with a spinning rod and with, you know, bobbers and worms and fishing off the dock at all these local ponds that we had close by. And then would get out occasionally with a couple of uncles and hit some bigger water, like the St. Croix and things like that. But it really wasn't until quite a bit later in life that I started to learn about what the Driftless was and spend more time out here. And once I realized what an amazing trout fishery it was very little hesitation before I took the plunge and started to figure out fly fishing and tying flies and stream entomology and all of that fun stuff. But you know, once I kind of took that leap, it was really eye opening. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed getting out and sort of the process of trying to understand what the puzzle is and then figure out how those pieces fit together every time I would hit the water was always really intriguing to me. I really enjoyed that sort of creative problem solving that was required to understand what the fish were eating, where they were holding, how to cast, how to present flies, all that stuff. So really enjoyed it. And so that's kind of where it took off. And many years later, I was in a drift boat with some buddies up on the upper Mississippi. And one of them happened to be working a little bit for trout routes. And yeah, it's funny, you know, we joke all the time that the trout routes team is so heavily involved in trout fishing, but we all are, you know, we love some good smallmouth fishing in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And can't get enough of that when the temperatures do warm up. But anyway, long story short, he said that this company was looking to hire for someone to help run and manage their partnerships programs. So I got connected very serendipitously through this friend of mine and had a chance to meet the owner. And it was around that time, back in 2022, that the Trout Routes founder was putting together that first team of full-time folks. So I was very fortunate to land that role and get a chance to work with some amazing people, both on the marketing side as well as on the software and GIS development side. And it's been an exciting run ever since. You know, that was back in late summer, early fall of 2022. And here we are in 2026. And we're now part of the Onyx family of mapping products. And it's been an amazing run. It's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah. And I mean, to be able to be a part of a startup like that, you know, kind of from not quite its inception, but those very early mm-hmm. stages in 2022 yeah. and being able to watch it grow and everything. What does that look like from, I guess, an internal standpoint at the company?
Yeah, you know, it was never a path that I expected to be on. I didn't really find myself in that startup or the software space through my early career. And so it was a lot of learning on the fly, a lot of quick changes and pivots. But it was really exciting. And it was a lot of fun to kind of bring that energy into the fly fishing space because, you know, there's a lot of room, I think, for growth and positive change in the fly fishing world. So we were really excited to be able to bring something new to that market. From a, you know, personal perspective, I was growing a ton, you know, every month, it seemed we were tackling new problems. We were seeing some new challenges, but because we were such a small, nimble team, we were able to make those pivots very quickly. So you learn to, you know, manage your time and make decisions based on as much information as you can gather in the moment and kind of stick to your guns. And we really spend those first couple of years running like crazy, just getting things pushed out on the development front and making connections with folks at expos and fly shows across the country. And it was really amazing. I of course knew the fly fishing community fairly well in the Twin Cities and here in the Driftless, but getting a chance to experience some of those smaller communities, not only in the West, but out East in the Southeast, other parts of the upper Midwest, was really cool. I, you know, fly fishing for me is one of those pursuits that, I think, like I mentioned, has all of these challenges and sort of problems that you can overcome creatively, but they can be very unique to the part of the country you're in. So I always really enjoy meeting folks that live outside of the Midwest, certainly, and are able to share what those experiences are like, because the way that you might catch trout in the Driftless is quite a bit different than you might catch trout out east or out west. And there's so much passion in these communities and enthusiasm for that pursuit of the outdoors that I really appreciate. So those first couple of years were a lot of fun. It was, you know, it wasn't easy, and there were a lot of long weekends and a lot of time away from home, but we made it happen, and the team was very successful. And so kind of migrating from that startup environment into a larger organization now with Onyx has also been very rewarding. We now, of course, have the resources of a much larger, more experienced company. So we are able to tap into some really amazing teams that are dedicated to specific data sets or methods of product development and basically everything in between. So to really go from, you know, startup mentality on one end of the spectrum all the way to larger org on the other end, it's been really, really amazing. It's not at all what I expected, you know, kind of mid-career, but it's been very rewarding, and I've been very appreciative of the folks that we've been able to meet and work with and connect with. And I think the growth and the development in the product really speaks to that. You know, we were initially kind of a scrappy startup project, and we've really grown into a very mature, trustworthy piece of software that I think is helping anglers get on the water. So having that sort of be the backbone of everything, you know, that through line has been very rewarding as well.
Dude, that's so cool. I mean, what a unique experience. And like, yeah, it's kind of the joys of being a part of the startup is you get to wear a bunch of different hats and do a little bit of everything. And especially on a small team right off the bat, I'm sure you know almost too much at sometimes, it seems. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's nowhere to hide either. Yep. You know, like you're all very exposed. But I think, you know, working with those guys for the first couple of years was just incredible, because we all became very quickly close friends and would spend time together on the water. And there's a level of intimacy there, I think, that is hard to find if you're on a larger team in some sense. So getting a chance to learn about the things that those guys were working on was really cool. I actually studied a little bit of geography back in college and did some GIS work, but it was nowhere near, you know, the level that our teams are at now. And so it was just kind of cool to also tap into some of that previous experience and bring a little bit of that knowledge full circle. And it's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome, dude. Well, it's like, in a way, I mean, you kind of touched on it there, like with getting to fish with folks all over the country and it being a part of different fisheries and how the styles differentiate and all that sort of stuff. It's like, I don't know, the two are kind of like analogous to one another in the sense that, like, you know, you fish with a guy out west and you pick up little things and nuances, or even just fishing with a smallmouth guy in the Midwest and then go back to the trout stream. You're like, oh, I could do this with my rod. And you know, just the little things you pick up and you know, can kind of apply to your own fishing pursuits or professional pursuits in those regards. That's super, super cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the things too that I think is so amazing, is that because you have so many different kinds of fisheries and they all require different approaches and techniques and stuff, there's a never ending list of things that you could learn in fly fishing. I find myself learning things every year, every season that I go out. And I think it's fun, like, kind of once you get over that initial hump of figuring out how to cast and understanding knots and, you know, some basic fly patterns and stuff, that it really just unlocks so many other rabbit holes that you could go down. I mean, you could spend the rest of your angling career only throwing streamers or only trying to match really specific hatches, or you know, only chasing migratory fish. Like, there are all these things that are technically under the same umbrella, but individually they're all so different that they offer a lot of really fun pursuits and fun directions that you can take it in. So that's one of the things that I think keeps bringing me back.
Yeah, definitely. Everybody's kind of wired similarly. And it's like that is definitely, like, although I don't know, like, I'm not a big migratory fish guy, but I talk to people who are super stoked about it, and it's just like, okay, I could see it. Yeah, I don't think you're crazy at all for spending that much time and traveling this distance and doing all that stuff in, you know, the dead of winter and swinging flies and waist deep 30 some degree water for hours on end. No, that's not crazy at all. I could see it, but
I mean, those will be the same guys who look right back at you and go, I don't think you're crazy for sitting in a deer stand for 12 hours and not seeing a single thing, but sitting there, you know, despite the the obvious like conditions that are not coming together. And I, you know, I think you could make that case for just about anything. It's all, everything has got their nuance. And I think it all requires a little bit of maybe eccentricity to get through, but that's okay. That's why we come back to it.
Yeah, definitely. The guys who are going down to the salt flats and harassing bonefish or, you know, punishing themselves, trying to catch a permit, get the same level of satisfaction, probably a little bit more if you're chasing permit than the guys in the Driftless do who are throwing
perhaps
hippie stompers and whatever.
I've bumped into plenty of anglers that get just as stoked by catching 3 or 4 inch native brook trout that sometimes, you know, it's an interesting reminder of like, maybe you just need to shift your perspective a little bit. And that guy who's really stoked on a 5 mile hike into the backcountry gets a level of reward that that guy on the flats boat will get as well. So, totally. And I think that, you know, that's, that kind of speaks to it as well. It's another one of those cool things where, there isn't, at least in my opinion, there isn't a best kind of fly fishing, you know, they all have really amazing things about them. And, that's the point, you know, tapping into that is what makes it really, really rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Totally. How have you guys had to adapt to those different regional needs and how to like, have there been things where it's like, this is super applicable out east or in PA or whatever in like mountain streams and not so much out west or in the Midwest? Like how have you guys had to adapt?
Yeah, that's a good question. One thing that comes to mind right away, and if you are listening from Wisconsin or from the upper Midwest, you'll probably appreciate this. Wisconsin is incredibly fortunate to have a vast swath of public land easement or private land easements that allow anglers to get on trout water. Oftentimes they're marked by a small, you know, the sign, it's a little postcard size thing that says, you know, fishing easement here, but sometimes that's all there is, you know, and it might be a path along a fence line. It might be, you know, traipsing through some underbrush to get down to the water, but we're very lucky that we have a lot of private landowners who have given the public access to trout fishing water. And so we spent a lot of time, especially in the early days, finding those easements, mapping them, and incorporating them into trout routes. But that level of easement access doesn't necessarily exist across the country. So spending that amount of time in other states, that didn't make any sense because there simply wasn't the amount of easement access. But what I think we take away from those kinds of experiences is not that the pursuit in a particular state wasn't warranted. It's that we just need to understand what the access looks like and how that fishing community interacts with it differently. So in states like Colorado or other states out west where there are far fewer public fishing easements, we just take a different approach and instead make sure that we were mapping all the public land that's within, you know, trout fishing water very accurately. So you have similar capability to find that kind of access. It might look different in the map, but it's just as valuable. I can think of another one too. You know, if you're fishing mostly in the Driftless, a lot of the water out here is really tight, you know, spring-fed creek, maybe a couple of feet wide at its skinniest. And doesn't make sense to try and throw a boat in there. Like there's no way you're going to get down that water. So having tools to support a drift boat angler don't make quite as much sense in the Driftless, but they make absolute sense if you're trying to fish out west or some of the bigger water out east. And so I think for us, it's really a matter of identifying what the core problems are that those anglers are trying to solve and then making sure that we've got the tools to support them. It sometimes means that the coverage or the amount of effort that we're putting into it, it's different depending on where we're mapping things in the country, but it doesn't mean that the level of detail is any less accurate or less important. It just shows up in different ways, right? To support those different angling communities.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I would imagine you've seen almost fishing culture shifts too, depending on how accessible water is in a various state. Like in Wisconsin, like you said, we're kind of spoiled where as long as your boots are wet, within reason, you know, you can be cutting through somebody's private, and, you know, as long as you stay in the creek and all that, it opens up a lot more opportunity. And people, I guess I don't want to say we're more stoked, we're more whatever. I don't know what we are more of, I guess. more lucky to have that level of access. But I would imagine that it changes a lot depending on, you know, if people are limited to only public land, they've got to be probably dealing with more pressure on that limited public water and so on and so forth, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we certainly see is, and I think when you're thinking about maybe angling perception shifts or behavior shifts, I think we've certainly, I mean, we Trout Routes has been around, you know, for going on 5 years now. And within that span, I think we have absolutely noticed more positive reception when it just comes to mapping technology in the fly fishing space. I know that when we were first getting ourselves out there, there was a lot of concern that we were exposing too much information, or that we were displaying public access or fishing information in a level of detail that was going to harm the fishery. Part of that was due to, you know, some competitors that were using tactics to collect data that we didn't agree with. You know, there are some ways that you could collect community information and then drop it into a map and make it look useful, but could truly be harming a fishery by overexposing or calling out too much detail or something like that.
And so, if you don't mind me asking,
sure. You know, there what we do at Trout Routes is show you where the trout rivers are. So giving you a lot of detail about those stream lines, what that topography looks like, providing detail about current conditions by pulling in stream gauge info, and then mapping all the public access associated with it. So whether that be an official access point with the, you know, the gravel pull off and the signpost marker, or whether that be the public land that exists, you know, bordering those waters. But what we don't do is tell you, you know, at this access point, there's a boulder and behind the boulder is a 20-inch trout and you should go there.
For sure.
We're not really interested in that. I think, number one, finding that amount of detail is near impossible because those fish are going to move around, and it's not something like that isn't going to end up being useful anyway. Mm-hmm. But that approach, I think, is removing a bit of the effort that is required by the angler to some extent, but is also trying to just give you the easy out button. We're not interested in that. We want you to find fishable water. We want you to explore new water, and we want you to understand how much water exists in this country that we have the amazing fortune to access. And so for us, it's really about being that extra tool in your fishing kit that is going to give you the confidence to know that you're accessing water legally, to help you navigate when you're out in the wild, if you are going to be somewhere outside of cell coverage, and make sure you have that data in your pocket before you hit the water. And then a way to help, you know, record and go back and remember those experiences down the line. And so once we started getting that message out to people, I think the angling community started to understand, oh, this isn't telling me where to go. It's telling me where I could go and how I could be successful there. But it's still up to me to figure out like what fly tie on, how to make the right cast, and whether or not I should mend the line, or, you know, all of those things. And that sort of general perception, I think, is what we've seen shift. I think, you know, as you know, fly anglers can be extremely protective of their home water or their secret spots. And I think as mapping technology continued to improve, there was generally a lot of concern, like, we're going to be those companies that are showing that information are going to threaten these environments. And I think I honestly feel like we've seen a shift to the opposite, where, you know, whether the number of anglers increases or not, I think it's our responsibility to help people understand where you can legally be accessing water, but then also, you know, what other opportunities exist beyond those commonly held or commonly known access points or rivers or things like that. So We've feel like we've seen anglers branching out more and really taking advantage of this kind of information. On the one hand, because it has existed for a long period of time, what we're doing is simply packaging it into a platform that makes it much easier to understand and interact between data sets. But we hear stories all the time from folks that are, you know, they fished the same creek for 20 years and they had no idea that on the other side of the ridge was a creek that had more trout in it, maybe, or, you know, had some different challenges that they could try and unlock. And they're really excited about, you know, having the tools to allow them to see not only that access, but to really understand like, wow, I've maybe been doing myself a disservice by going to the same bridge or the same access point year over year, and instead giving them the confidence to branch out and experience something different.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Definitely. That's super cool, man. Because, yeah, I've definitely heard some gripes in the driftless of people like, oh, well, Trout Routes is, you know, selling out these spots and like this used, nobody used to know about this. I'm like, well, people, everybody's known about this. Like it's been on Google Maps. It's been on Onyx. Mm-hmm. It's been on the DNR sure. trout regulations for crying out loud. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, maybe people didn't show up, but it's always been public. It's always been available. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like that's half the fun of the driftless is seeing all that opportunity. And, you know, even if you just go to the DNR trout maps mm-hmm. online or whatever, and you sure. see all those green and blue lines, and it's like, I could throw a dart and see what right. happens and just like pick a spot and go for it. But also yeah. the number of spots that, like, I don't know, because I was pre-Trout Routes, my methodology was like, okay, DNR map, Google mm-hmm. Maps, and two separate windows, and I would sit there yep. and, you know, go back and forth between the two. And the number of water or like spots that I found, I was like, well, this looks like crap. Like I'm not gonna spend any time here. Or the number of yeah. like people who it's like, I don't know, I've had people show me their Trout Routes or their Onyx and be like, oh yeah, I got pins marked here. I was going to check out this, going to check out that. And it's like, I know you and I know what that bridge looks like and I know how wooded it is and I know yeah. you're not going anywhere near that. You're going to yeah. slow down, look over, mm-hmm. say, probably not, and keep on driving. Like,
yeah.
And that's, yeah, I mean, that's what a lot of folks, you know, they neglect to consider is that, like, yes, this information is not readily available on an app that's pretty and organized and mm-hmm. you know, shows the access points very clearly, but it's mm-hmm. by no means spot burning anything more yeah. than, you know, the average, I mean, more than the DNR is, at least I'll say sure. or put it that way,
or in some cases more than like what your local fly shop is willing to give out. I think
totally yeah.
I think it's an interesting sort of two sides of the same coin where we sometimes take the brunt of that negative or frustrated concern, but I would challenge you to find a fly angler anywhere that hasn't walked into a fly shop at some point and said, where should I go and what should I throw at them? And that fly shop will be the first ones to tell you exactly where and exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to sort of navigate both of those things, where, you know, we want to be supportive of anglers and helping them find that new access and certainly be on that side of the coin where we're open and willing to share information, but not interested in collecting user data or, you know,
totally.
Community generated content or anything like that. Everything in there is vetted and accurate based on our trusted sources. So, but you know, like I said, I'm happy to say that we've seen a bit of a shift when it comes to some of that stuff. And like you said, I can show you the access point. It's still up to you to hike in and actually get yourself there. And mm-hmm. The old adage continues to be true of, you know, the best fishing can oftentimes be as far as you can get from the access point. So
yep.
it's still up to the angler to get in the water and figure out where they're headed and put in the effort to get to those spots that they're interested in. And I'm afraid I can't really help them there. It's, you know, yep. that's still up to you. It's still your own 2 feet or your boat or whatever it is that you're doing to get on the water. And, so as long as we can be supportive on that back end, that's what we're interested in doing. And then we're excited to help, anglers unlock some of that new potential.
Totally. Yeah. And that's such an important distinction that, like, you guys are not telling people there's no pin in Trout Routes. This is like, oh, here's the big boulder, here's the big undercut, here's where you need to stand, and here's like how you need to present that fly or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like no matter, even if you did do that, trout routes is not going to fix your crappy cast. So it's just
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Folks definitely need to consider that. But
and you know, you mentioned Onyx a couple times. We are, like I mentioned at the top, part of Onyx now. It's something that I think a lot of folks are still getting word of. But in the same way that, you know, Onyx Hunt isn't going to show you where the, you know, 14 pointer is going to be bedded down that morning you head out into the field, it's we're adopting the same sort of methodology of providing accurate data and tool sets to help you find success. It's still really up to you to understand some of the nuance between those things and have the motivation to get out there yourself. And you know, I know Onyx experiences similar concerns to some extent sometimes, and it's part of it. But you know, at the end of the day, it's really all about public access, and I think helping anglers, especially, understand how much public access we have to experience helps us in the long run to protect those spaces and make sure that we're standing up for that access when it starts to come under threat. So the more we can kind of spread that message and make people aware, I think too helps that in the long run.
Yeah. And that's something I think both you and Onyx have done an outstanding job of. It's like, any, especially in the last 12, 18 months or so, as public lands have started to come under fire a little bit, being able to just pull it up and very clearly say like, hey, here's all this up-to-date data right here. Like, look at all the stuff that's at risk right here. We got to do something about this.
It's really you know, you mentioned that we're a little spoiled here in Wisconsin in that we've got access to all this trout water. I think it can be easy sometimes to forget that, you know, as a country, we are incredibly fortunate to have all this public land, you know, built into, you know, the foundation of the country. And this is not how a lot of the world operates. Trying to trout fish like this elsewhere in the world is really challenging. We just want to make sure that we keep bringing light to those issues, and the more anglers we can get on the water and get to experience some of the incredible spaces that we have right outside the back door sometimes is all part of it as well.
Yeah, totally. And like you said, giving them the tools at hand to make sure that they're using these spaces properly so that they can in turn, whether they're new or they're experienced or they're visiting or whatever it is, they can be a good steward of the land and of these resources so that we can hopefully get more people on board with protecting them. On the note of trout routes, man, we talked about, you know, kind of the access points and stuff like that. How do you personally tend to use trout routes? Like, what are some of the features that you, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I sometimes need to pull myself out a little bit because I'm so in the weeds on a day-to-day basis. But I was thinking about that as I start to head into a bit of early season travel, as we start to head out to some of the fly fishing shows and things like that. I am lucky that I have a chance to travel a bit for work, and sometimes am able to get that to run in tandem with a little bit of time on the water. And so I have found myself in plenty of parts of the country where I've never been, I've never fished, and I have no idea where I'm headed. And so some of the things that I'm using in trout routes, especially when it comes to exploring some of that new water, is really, before I do anything else, just kind of take a high level approach of looking at an area that I'm going to be, or maybe think about, you know, if I'm going to be here, I know I could get within an hour pretty easily. So what does that give me in terms of opportunity? And I'll honestly just start taking a look at our stream classification system, which is going to color code all of those different trout streams dependent on amount of trout, amount of public access, health of habitat, things like that, to kind of hone in on some of those areas that might be an easier first approach. I'm probably not going to try and find a spot that has one access point that requires a long hike in. I'm probably going to start looking for spots that have a little bit more of that dedicated access point marker, on them, and have a bit more of that green public land mapped on them. And that's sort of where I start. You know, once I kind of hone in on a couple of areas, that then I start to dig a little bit deeper and maybe select a couple of rivers that I'm interested in. And from there, what I'll start to do is use a combination of our satellite imagery as well as those public land parcel polygons to get a sense of where I can get on the water, how far up or downstream I could go if I want to explore a little bit. Maybe I've got a couple of access points to choose from. And then from there, I'll start to jot down some notes. So I'll either jump into those access point icons and add my own notes there, or I'll create some new markers where I can go back and say, oh yeah, when I was looking at this on the big screen, I wanted to go here because this has a good bend in it and it looks like it might be a deeper pool. So I'm going to make sure I remember that before I even head out. And that's just kind of a quick, you know, you could do that very easily. Like I said, I usually will do that up on a bigger monitor so you can log into your account on a desktop the same way you could do so with Onyx. But that allows me to see a little bit more of the map. It allows me to sort of compare and contrast things together. But from there, you know, I've got maybe two or three rivers selected. I've got some markers that I've jotted down some notes in. So I've got an idea of what I might be throwing, why I wanted to go to that particular spot, or anything else I would want to remember. Maybe it's like, I want to hike to this point and that's going to be my halfway point. So I'm going to drop a pin for that reason. So then when I get out to that part of the country, I've got, you know, a bunch of notes. I've got a bunch of access points jotted down. I've got some rivers that I want to explore already sorted out. So when I start to head out to the water to actually fish it, that's when I would download those sections offline to make sure I don't lose any of that coverage if I happen to get outside of cell service. And then just kind of call up those markers and remind myself why I was thinking about those areas in the first place. And those features are not particularly deeply embedded. They're not very complicated. We've got some tools in there that are much more, you know, kind of advanced angler data sets. But I think you can accomplish an awful lot if you just looked at stream class, if you dropped some pins and you downloaded some of that data to your mobile device. And that's it. Like, just doing that is going to get you, you know, 80 to 90% of the way there, I think. And so that's kind of my quick e-scouting rundown of how I'm approaching some new water and some of the things that I'm using. If you wanted to get a little bit more specific, you know, depending on what water I'm looking at, if it's got some stream gauge data, I'll call that up and kind of understand what the current conditions are, or maybe even look back at some historical data to see what that stream looks like depending on different times of the year. So if I'm going to be somewhere in April, let's go back and look at last April and see how high the water was, how fast it was moving, to try and get a sense of, like, is this a section I should wade? Is this a section I should, you know, try to fish from the bank? You could get a little deeper with some like river miles calculating. So if you wanted to know how long a particular stretch is, you can drop some markers and use the river miles tool to figure out the distance between two points on that water. Again, could be useful if you wanted to understand how far I want to hike in. And maybe I only want to go 3 miles before I turn around and then that'll be my full day. Or maybe I don't want to go more than a half mile and make sure I don't go beyond a particular section or point on that water. So there's tons of info in there that you could really spend an awful lot of time digging into. But really, I think you can accomplish an awful lot if you're looking at stream class, looking for those blue access point icons to know where those dedicated access points are, and then kind of using that in tandem with the additional mapped public land parcels to know where along that river you're going to have all that access.
Totally. That's awesome, dude. Yeah, I'm right there with you with that kind of more high level, 90% of the way there, use of the app and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, just in my limited experience playing around with it so far, like, that's exactly what I've done as well. And knowing now that I've got the River Miles feature to play around with just to answer some questions that aren't going to do me a whole lot of good aside from just knowing what I did, like,
yeah, right.
I'm definitely stoked to dive further into that. That's super cool information to have. At the end of the day, too, it's like, download the map so you know exactly where you are, where you need to be, and, you know, all that stuff that you saved ahead of time. But for the most part, like we're not trying to be on our phones the entire time we're out there on the water. Yeah. Like most people want to be fishing while they're out there. So using it as that preliminary tool and then filling in some of the gaps as you go,
exactly.
And find some of those sweet spots, or maybe there's a surprise tree that fell across or something. Mm-hmm. You didn't know about, like,
that's... Yeah, totally. I mean, that's another good point. Like, I rarely have my phone in hand when I'm out on the water. I'm, you know, I'm trying to get locked in on the stream and trying to catch some fish, but, certainly for things like, you know, a major downed tree, or maybe I get to a bend and like, I find the honey hole, like maybe I want to remember that. So using some of those custom marker tools, to add some notes while I'm on the water can be super helpful as well. So that I know, like, if I ever get back here, like, this is a really good spot. I thought it was going to be in the bend. It's actually a little bit downstream, but here it is. Make sure you stop there again when you come back next time. So I have been using, trout routes a little bit more as kind of that, fishing journal, right? So it's a way to record what I was up to, what the conditions were like, maybe to drop in a photo of a particularly nice fish that I've caught or something like that. So it can also be a really helpful tool, to drop in that information while you're out there, or even in, you know, if you get back to the truck or get back to your, wherever you're staying, to add some of those reminders, can also be really fun too. So you have a record that you could look back on down the road.
Yeah, definitely. Or even drop a pen, send it to a buddy if he's going to be out there the next week or so. Like if you're willing, if you're that good of buddies with them, like,
of course. I mean, we've mentioned a couple times that, you know, none of this data gets collected by Trout Routes. So anything that you would do in your account, it's going to live in your account. It's all protected under your actual Trout Routes account. So we're not seeing any of that. We're not sharing that to anybody. So I will leave it up to you whether or not you feel confident in your fishing partner's ability to keep their lips sealed. Mm-hmm. But you're right. That can also be another really helpful sort of function. It's if I'm going to meet up with somebody when I'm out there, I can send them some pins ahead of time and say, hey, I think we should meet at this parking lot. And then I think we should hike into this access point. So here are those two pins. You can send them to their account and they can have access to that too. So really, really kind of unique ways of sharing that information and having it be that navigational tool between fishing partners for sure is really, really helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
I've certainly used that before. Like if I'm going to be on the water a couple of hours before the rest of the crew is going to show up, like I'll let them know, hey, this is where I put in. I'm going to head upstream and I'm going to head to here. So if you don't see me, walk upstream until you get to this bend, and like I'll stop, you know, at this marker and wait for you guys. Sure. So it can be a really useful way to kind of coordinate some of that stuff too, especially if you're traveling and trying to meet up with some folks while you're out in the wild.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the integration with Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever you know, your phone has is like just super cool and helpful to be able to have that pin dropped and also be able to just be like, oh yeah, I do want to drive there. Perfect. Rather than having to do the old back and forth between the apps and all that.
Yeah, like, exactly.
What road was that? What did that bridge look like? Oh yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And if you happen to be in a vehicle that has CarPlay, that's another fun one that I'll pull up when I'm out on the road. While you can't navigate in it like you can with Google or Apple Maps yet, you can still call up the base map and you can see, like, as you're driving, like if you cross a bridge, it'll let you know if it has trout in it. And you can kind of use that to navigate a little bit as well. That's actually pretty fun, especially when I'm somewhere new. I know where I'm headed. I know I'm going to get to this access point, but as I'm driving up there, I'm going to keep a lookout because, you know, what trout angler is not guilty of approaching a small, sometimes one lane bridge and going, this looks pretty good. I wonder if I should hop in here real quick. And so it can help kind of break some of that down for you while you're driving through some of that backcountry.
Totally. That is the perfect application for it. Yeah. If there ever was one. It's just, especially in the driftless where it's just there every.
Oh, I know. It's almost corner too distracting, right?
Like it's hazardous at that point.
It's every bridge. So I don't know if it becomes useful at that point, if it's every single bit of water has trout, but you know, you can at least still get a sense of like where those rivers snake through. And it's kind of fun to see that up on the CarPlay screen.
Yeah, totally, dude. Well, dude, in addition to your connection with Trout Routes and stuff, you've also got your own little fly business going on the side with Weights and Measures. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's right. I mentioned this to you when we were kind of corresponding before this session, but I was impressed that you had done a little extra homework and tracked that down. I have been tying flies.
I lose a lot of flies. It's
yeah, yeah, totally. I'm right there with you. That's why I started tying them. but yeah, I've been tying under weights and measures for a number of years now, and actually got really into it as I, at the same time, was getting kind of down the rabbit hole of fishing for muskie on a fly rod. So I got really interested in bucktail and tying big streamers and big, you know, Buford head bucktail flies. I'm kind of ramping up that program as we speak. It's been kind of quiet over the last couple of years as our family made a significant move out here to Wisconsin. But like I mentioned, you know, it's very cold here in the Driftless, and it's not a whole lot else to do outdoors. And so I've been getting back to the vise. And so when I started getting into that, I mean, I had, of course, been tying flies for the Driftless and for trout for a number of years. And then as I sort of made that shift into fishing for bass and other warm water species, it's when I started to get into those big streamers. And the same way that you can go down the rabbit hole, you know, with just about anything in fly fishing. I did the same thing with fly tying, and I started collecting up as many bucktails as I could get my hands on through deer hunting season and connecting with family and friends who were out in the woods and harvesting deer, and started to figure out how to, you know, process and dye all of those fibers, which I thought was really interesting. And what I liked about that aspect of it was it allowed me to come up with some really interesting colors that I wasn't able to find, you know, on the fly shop shelf. And so that's sort of where I started to turn that into a little bit more of an official side hustle, where I was tying more of those flies and getting some of those out to some fly shops here in the upper Midwest. And I had a couple of folks out east that I was sending those flies to as well at the time. But I love it. It's a lot of fun. It's, you know, like I said, anything in fly fishing has a rabbit hole you can go down, but it was just really cool to start picking apart flies and patterns that I was fishing and seeing where I could either make improvements or just tweak here and there to make them do different things. And so that's been a lot of fun just to learn how all that works and things like that. And like I said, I really enjoyed that sort of creative outlet. For me, it was just as rewarding to come up with some really cool colorways and, you know, tinker around in the garage and in the basement lab, as it were, coming up with these weird, funky colors. And what I liked about that anyway was coming up with colors that were really in that natural sort of color palette that I wasn't really able to find. So some really deep kind of olive drab, pale yellows, light, you know, tans, things like that. So, yeah, that's really where it started, and it kind of took off, and, I had plenty of buddies that were interested in those flies. So I just kept it rolling and came up with weights and measures. And actually, the story behind the name for that business comes from the Driftless. And if you ever stop for gas in Wisconsin, you'll see a little marker on the gas pump that says, you know, this is certified by the Department of Weights and Measures. And for some reason that always stuck with me. It was, you know, I would have to stop for gas, and who doesn't love a gas station lunch or something when you're doing a little trout fishing out here. And for whatever reason, that just always stuck with me. And so when I was thinking about how I was going to come up with that brand design, that was what came to mind. So anyway, that's a little fun fact for your listeners about where that comes from. But yeah, like I said, I'm getting back in the swing of things, tying up a bunch of musky flies right now for some clients, and have actually been spending a bit of time trying to perfect a couple of trout streamer patterns that I'm hoping to fish as soon as it gets a little bit warmer out here. So expect to see more on that front, but I'd encourage you all to follow along or even just check out the Instagram page if you're curious, because there's some pretty rad stuff going on over there. And yeah, it's fun. It's a fun creative outlet, like I said, but it's really just another piece that I like to explore and unpack and sort of tinker around with. So that's really where all that started to come from.
Dude, that's sick. That's, and like, I don't know how cool to, because I knew I'd seen weights and measures somewhere, but I couldn't like put my finger on where exactly. I love that. Yeah. That's the connection to it. But dude, even cooler too, that you're able to like harvest those bucktails from, you know, friends and family, and mm-hmm. you kind of, I don't know, it's like one of the joys of fly tying, right? It's like, especially when you can like right. source your own feathers or your own stuff yeah. from either stuff that you harvested or a friend or a family member did, and like have that personal connection to the bug and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff, and yeah. just makes it that much sweeter when you actually hook one and pull
yeah,
it out
totally.
Of the mouth. Like,
to be clear, this is a small operation, you know, like I'll do a couple of hundred bucktail maybe in a season. And even that's kind of a lot for me. And there are a lot of folks that are kind of getting into that bucktail and natural fiber dying game.
It's
wild. There was a period there for a while where I couldn't even get anything from like local butcher shops because they were in such high demand. There was sort of a mm-hmm. a period a couple of years ago where it was really hard to find quality bucktail. And I think that pendulum is starting to swing back a little bit, but it also became quite expensive, you know, if you're spending $12 to $14 or more dollars on a single tail. I thought, well, I can probably figure out how to do this. And if I really only need, you know, a couple dozen a year on some of the smaller project stuff, I bet I could track down some buddies and see if they would just cut the tail off the deer that they're shooting for deer season and send them my way. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of also where that came from. It's cool. And I've been able to make some other connections where some folks are, you know, sending me other feathers, or they want me to tie like some pheasant tail nymphs with a bird they shot during upland season or something like that. So, that's also really cool. Like I love that connection and being able to put something together that has, you know, some value and some meaning to the individual. And, I get to put, you know, my spin on it, on the fly side. And, that's always a lot of fun.
Dude, totally. And what a unique way to, I don't know, what a unique little side hustle to have there, like to just offer that to people, like people who might not, you know, whether it's, hey, that's fly fisherman age, right? And, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. the arthritis kicks in, or totally. The vision's not as good as it was or once was. And I mean, size 18 and 20 bugs are, even for mm-hmm. younger guys, tough to tie on.
I'll admit I'm starting to approach that point that at which maybe I need to hang up those tiny hooks for good. We'll see.
It's scary, man. Soon we'll be the old guys with the little clacks around our
neck. I haven't gotten them yet, but man, I know it's just a matter of time. And I'm growing my beard out right now for the first time in maybe a couple of years, year and a half or so. And, mm-hmm. I'm noticing a lot more white coming through than I remember. Mm. And I'm going, oh boy, maybe this is a mistake.
That's awesome, dude. Well, another thing too, that I noticed on your website, you know, it's not just musky flies. Like, you got some smallmouth patterns in there, some popper patterns in mm-hmm. there. So it's you're well rounded in your the stuff.
Yeah, honestly, that really is kind of comes out of like I like to fish for all those species. I love smallmouth mm-hmm. fishing. I love topwater fishing. Some of the poppers that I was coming out with were, you know, sort of modified. Articulated tail, you know, like mini Game Changer style,
sure.
Or using the Game Changer platform, throwing a couple of sections in off the back of that larger hook. But, you know, then I got really into coming up with some crazy colorways to paint those popper heads and trying to mimic, you know, leopard frogs or chorus frogs that I was seeing on the stream side and trying to translate that into the actual pattern. So, Some of them are probably over engineered to my fault. but that, you know, that's part of it too, is I just like to come up with some of those really interesting patterns and ideas. And, I like fishing flies that I, you know, like to look at. So I think totally. if you're willing to pay more attention to a fly that's a little bit more colorful or has, you know, some extra pattern on it or something, I think, you know, all the better. And hopefully that'll mean that you don't miss a hook set or two if things start to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's at the very least, it builds that mojo a little bit when you're in one end of the boat and your buddy's just got like some big like chartreuse or white hunk of foam that like,
yeah,
hopefully isn't getting eaten better than what you tie, but
yeah, right.
At the very 100%. Least, it's a reason to cuss him out a little bit, but
yeah, totally. But yeah, man, that was fun. It's there's all kinds of stuff going on over there, and like I said, I'm starting to get really back in the swing of things as we you know, part of the problem was I had to move my whole workshop out here, and that mm-hmm. quickly became overrun with other priorities. And so I'm finally getting to a point where I've got some space carved out, and it's actually been a lot of fun too. Like our boys are a little bit older now, and the last several weekends we've all, like, the whole family honestly has kind of been just taking some time on Saturday morning, and we all have our own little hobbies or crafts that we're doing. And so we'll sit down at the big craft table and I'll spin up some big musky bugs, and the boys will start drawing, or, you know, they're getting into like little model building right now, which is super cool. You know, and my wife will be up there in the cozy chair knitting something for one of the kids, and it's great. I'm interested because I want to get some more of these flies back on the market, but I think it's also a great reminder that, like, there is so much value in slowing down a little bit and just putting your mind at ease by focusing on something that's right in front of you and something that you enjoy. So it's certainly become, you know, certainly this year, a chance for us to pass that along to the kiddos. It's just really cool to see them kind of picking up that vibe. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. It's completely a side hustle. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to allow me to retire early. but it's fun. And it's, I'm always excited to share that with folks. And if I can get some cool bugs in your hands that you can go out and chase some big fish with, all the better.
Dude, totally. That's super cool, man. Well, you mentioned that you also are working on a couple of driftless or trout focused streamer patterns and stuff. How does the musky smallmouth, not asking for specific patterns, but I'm curious, like, are there elements of like the musky bugs or the smally bugs that you try and incorporate into your driftless bugs? And
yeah, you know, I don't want to take anything away from folks that are, you know, developing new patterns or coming out with new commercially viable, like, patterns for some big brands. Like, I don't spend near enough time on the water to have that amount of, you know, access and necessity for trying to tweak things too much. I think I also, you know, I don't necessarily love the idea of like changing the color of something and then calling it a new pattern. Like, I'm not going to take credit for that. Like, yeah. I can put my own riff on something, but I want to make sure I give credit to the folks that are doing the actual work and putting the time in on the water. But one of the things that has been interesting to, as I think about what's translated from tying some of those bigger bugs into some smaller trout stuff, is thinking about color in ways that maybe I hadn't before. Mm-hmm. I think we get sort of hit over the head with, you know, throwing streamers that are black or olive or white. But there are so many other things to work with that are worth exploring. And actually, I had some of the most success on a small trout streamer this last season because it was just a pretty standard, you know, squirrel tail, like, bead head jig. There wasn't mm-hmm. a whole lot to the pattern. You can tie it in any color you want, but I tied it in peach. It was like a light peach Ooh. With a little bit of white. And for whatever reason, I would throw that pattern in three or four different colors, and the peach color would get hammered every time. And I don't know if it's, I mean, I certainly don't think those fish are seeing a lot of pressure. So I don't think it has much to do with, you know, them seeing a lot of black or olive flies, because I can see the trails that aren't particularly, you know, set down. And I know folks aren't really getting back into some of these spots. And so for whatever reason, that was the one color that was doing it for him last season. Mm-hmm. And so I like to kind of keep exploring that and remind myself that, like, you don't need to change, or, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Sometimes you can just kind of put a little twist on something that you know works, and you'll still find quite a bit of success. So that would be one recommendation for folks that are getting into some fly tying, or they've got some things that they're trying to get after, is I wouldn't worry about trying to come up with something new. The pattern that works probably already exists. But think about some subtle ways that you can tweak it and put your own spin on it. And then get out in the water and see if it works. You know, like, I was shocked that, like, a light peach with a little bit of white was the ticket. You know, I would never have guessed. But
we're talking like a fly that's like an inch in length, right? Like
it's about 2 inches.
Two inches.
Yeah, it's I think I tied that on a size 8.
Okay, so a little bigger.
Size 4-8 hook. Yep. So it was a bigger hook, but it wasn't articulated. It just, you know, it had a little bit of squirrel tail off the back to give it some extra length. But it's a simple pattern, man. It was like 3 materials, a little bit of weight, and not a whole lot to it. And it was, you know, way more useful and valuable than a lot of the fancy articulated stuff that I was also tying that I thought looked really cool, but was not doing it. So
yeah, and I would imagine.
I will say there was a point, however, I just got done ranting about like don't be too complicated, but there was a point this summer where I was fishing that fly, and I had a couple of casts where I was getting chased down by a big fish, and I thought, well, he's not taking this one. I'm not really sure why, and so I threw on a very overly engineered feather game changer. It had shingled pheasant feathers along the back, like the whole 9 yards. Mm-hmm. And it was like 6 inches long. I was like, this is way too big, but I'm going to see what happens. And I love that fly because it moves so much in the water. But, you know, sometimes I think those bigger flies spook the trout in the driftless more than anything. And they might chase it down, but they're not really interested in eating it. They're just trying to get it out of their way. And sure enough, like first cast, like this fish hammers it. And, you know, it was the other side of that coin, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
totally.
It didn't want anything to do with that light peach, but it wanted everything to do with that really fancy, you know, hour and a half long tie that I came up with earlier. So, you know, it's one of those things where you can make things as complicated as you want. But like I said, I would encourage folks, like, don't think you need to have things be super complicated. You can start simple. You know, you can tie. I'm always really impressed by folks that can tie simple patterns very cleanly, because there isn't really anywhere for you to hide behind. You know, like if you need to tie something that only requires 5 thread wraps, then you only use 5 thread wraps. Like if you, you know, and the folks that have the confidence to really stick to some of that stuff, I think it's really impressive. So there are, you know, a lot of things on Instagram and social media that look really fancy, but it's about the stuff that actually works well in the water and catches fish. So don't lose sight of that either.
Yeah, 100%. The fish could care less how long you spent tying that fly.
And exactly.
Or what rare feather, however expensive it was, all that stuff.
Yeah, dude, totally.
That's awesome. So in terms of streamer approach in the driftless, are you generally a start small, then increase in size? Or I guess obviously this is a big, it depends, you know, high water, muddy water, low, clear, whatever it may be.
To be honest with you, I rarely throw anything that's longer than maybe 4 inches.
Mm-hmm. Same.
I think it's easy to get really excited about a huge articulated fly and think that's going to be the ticket. So I'll usually start smaller. If the water is a little off color and, you know, a good amount of rain has just come through, that's when I might start to size up a little bit. But I found more success this last season by downsizing and going smaller. Kind totally. Of in that, you know, 2-inch, 2.5-inch sweet spot was what was really doing it. And it seemed like, you know, I think anyone knows you could throw a woolly bugger anywhere in the driftless and catch some fish. So I like to be a little bit more exciting than a woolly bugger.
Mm-hmm.
But I it was almost as if, you know, those, a woolly bugger is what, 1.5 inches? Maybe 2 inches, depending on if it's on a big hook and it's got a big marabou tail. It was almost as if something that was just a little bit bigger was like large enough that those bigger fish needed to get it out of their lane, but small enough that they could feel confident in chopping it and, you know, having it be gone for good.
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, that kind of like 2.5-3 inch sweet spot was what was doing it for me. So I've been trying to remind myself of that as I'm getting back into tying some smaller trout streamers, is a lot of those patterns are designed to be fished out west or on much larger water. And so it's been a bit of a challenge to sort of downsize some of that stuff. But at the same time, a lot of fun to try and come up with a dungeon or a, you know, a peanut envy or something that's on a couple of size 10 or eight hooks. Like it's totally. It's not easy because you don't have a whole lot of real estate. So it's been fun to kind of, you know, be really diligent about, like I said, thread wraps and the amount of material that I'm using to make sure that it doesn't overwhelm the size of the hook, but can still move around in the water. That's kind of where I've been at lately, is kind of playing around with some of that stuff, trying to take some of those larger patterns and figuring out how we can downsize them to fit the water that we've got in our backyard.
Totally, dude. We are very aligned in that approach, I think.
It's funny because it seems very common sense, but it took me a while to get there. And it's one of those things where it's like, man, if I would have just like listened to the folks that know what they're doing, I would have been here years ago. But, you know, who also doesn't like throwing a big 6 or 8 inch streamer on a really juicy
cut? Oh, when it gets choked, like, for sure.
It's like, you might as well give it a shot, you know, like swing for the fences if you are given the opportunity. So
Definitely.
I'm guilty.
Well,
of that,
and I mean,
for sure.
Half the time too, they're just fun to watch. Like when they do exactly what you want and that retrieves perfect. It's like, ooh, that should have got bit. Even if it doesn't. You get that little bit of satisfaction from it.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Yeah. I had plenty of turnoffs this year that were like, oh man, that was a large fish. And if he wanted to eat it, he would have, but he was just trying to get me out of his way. And it's like, oh God. And, you know, then you spend 45 minutes trying to get something to slide under that bank and then lose something on the log that's right behind it or whatever.
Yep.
That's how it goes, right?
It's the fun of the driftless, man.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome, dude. Well, dude, I've got two questions for you here before we wrap up. I know we're approaching an hour here, just over. My second to last question here. If you were given one weekend to fish anywhere in the Midwest with perfect conditions, what are those conditions? Where and when are you going, and what fly are you throwing?
I won't name the creek, but I learned to fly fish in the Driftless, and it's a spot that I've been going back to for years. At this point, gosh, probably 12 almost 15 years now. And I've talked about it on other podcasts before, so it's no secret, but for the purposes of this answer, I'm going to leave that off. But it's been a lot of fun to see this stretch go from pretty overgrown and mismanaged to a spot that has amazing access, really strong and consistent habitat restoration work in the water itself. And, you know, despite it being somewhat more commonly known, I don't encounter a lot of anglers on it because it has a lot of areas that people can get on the water. So it has some pretty cool public access and availability. So I'd pick this creek, and mostly for sentimental value, just because I think it's beautiful and it's right in one of those quintessential Driftless river valleys where you've got old farmsteads off in the distance and, you know, the sunset over the ridge line and things like that. So I would get out there late summer, and it would be kind of one of those warm late summer evenings. And I'd be throwing hoppers at the tall grassy banks and catching fish on topwater. Just because it's so much fun to see those fish get aggressive like that when they see grasshoppers dropping into the water. And also because there are some sections of this creek that are a foot wide, and I've caught some unusually large fish out of areas that I would have typically just walked through. So it's a fun spot where you can get creative with bow and arrow casts or little tight roll casts like over your shoulder. And it has a little bit of everything. It's got some deep pools. It's got some good runs. So that's what I'd pick. Local and nostalgic creek. In one of those kind of last warm summer evenings when grasshoppers are going off and those fish kind of come out from those undercut banks for a last evening meal.
Totally, dude. I love that image there. That was, as you were saying that with like the ridge or the sun setting over the ridge and everything, man, I was like,
I mean, I could picture
smell
it.
That sweet, like late summer, that dewy. I was like, oh, I can't wait for that.
Yeah. Maybe you start to get a little bit of fog coming off the water as the sunset goes down. And yeah, man, it's the most fun.
Dude, absolutely. It's the best. Gosh, this has me excited for warmer weather. I mean, maybe
I would say something different if you asked me a couple months from now, but I'm sure it has a lot to do with it being so cold. And I just needed to get out on some warm water here soon.
Dude, but, for sure. Yeah. For sure, man. Well, dude, this has been absolutely fantastic. I appreciate the heck out of you for coming on dropping so much knowledge on trout routes and the driftless. And dude, I just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation talking trout with you, dude.
I did as well. It's always fun to chat with other local folks. And I know we haven't had a chance to get out on water because like we were saying before we hopped on record, we've had a great winter. It's been mild. We've had some snow, but it hasn't been too cold. And sure enough, as we're trying to connect the dots, it dips down into well below freezing temperatures. So we got hit a little bit on this one, but we'll have to make sure we get out on some water here as the season starts to warm up. And
dude, definitely
put some of these flies to the test, perhaps, and see
dude,
what we
for
can get
sure.
into.
Yeah, that early spring, hopefully after the runoff and everything, when it finally starts warming up and the fish start waking up a little bit, we'll have to beat on them a little bit with some streamers and do a little R&D for sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
Awesome, dude. Well, man, before we wrap up, where can folks go if they want to learn more about trout routes, about weights and measures, follow along with you?
Yeah, totally. If you're curious to know more about trout routes, just find us on the website at troutroutes.com or look us up on social under the same handle. We do a lot of stuff on our social channels, as well as on YouTube. We've got some really informative stuff there. So I would encourage you to look us up really across platforms. And then if you wanted to learn more about me or more about Weights and Measures, you can find me on socials as well. That handle is at Weights and Measures Co. Or you could find me at weightsandmeasuresco.com if you wanted to look that website up as well. Feel free to reach out directly, or if you have questions or are wondering about stuff, you can find me there. You can also track down my personal account, which is just under Eric Johnson as well. So happy to chat fishing and fly tying all the time. So please reach out. We'd love to connect.
Awesome, dude. Yeah, send the man some bucktails next fall, guys. He's got
indeed. I'll take.
He's got to stay busy.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, dude, this has been fantastic, man. Seriously, I appreciate your time and all you're doing for just conservation and you know, protecting these fisheries, and as well as just putting them on the map, quite literally putting them on the map. And
indeed,
and all that.
It was great. Great chatting with you. I appreciate the time too. It's been a lot of fun, and looking forward to keeping these conversations going. That's for sure.
Yeah, likewise, dude. Well, man, we'll be in touch about getting on the water. But until then, man, stay warm, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, sounds good. We'll see you later.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.